We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you.
And that's our message for the good old USA police state. Yeah, that's my new sign out in front of the houses. Let's see, what does it say? Yeah, it says Homeland Insecurity. That's what it says. And that means police state. Yeah, I'm getting a lot of honks for that one. The drivers, hundreds that go by my house every day, I think they like that one. I have guys actually stop their cars on a 90-degree curve in the road. It's very dangerous. Stop and read that sign. I'm telling you, I hope nobody gets killed. And this is White Aryan Resistance Radio Network calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio Network calling right here in north central Indiana, in the farmland where we do our best to feed the people. And hopefully we're not shipping too much of this stuff out to the WOGs. You're right, yeah. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations and for the radio show. And we're getting a lot of men here early in the month this time. And I like that. That helps me out to keep track of everything. Because if you start sending it out after the 15th, it's a problem because I'm not sure whether you're sending for the first of the following month or the first of the preceding month. And I can get confused, and then you could get accidentally dumped or something. And we wouldn't want that to happen. Well, I don't know what to make of this one. I got a book sent to me here and a bunch of political propaganda from a guy by the name of Hardy. And he's running for Senate. Out of Whittier, California. I didn't know there was any black people. Well, there used to not be any black people allowed in Whittier. That's where Nixon was from, you know. But he's black as the ace of spades, and he says he's a black Hitler. He says, Kobe, LeBron, Goebbels conquers America. And this big, thick, really neat book. It's pretty. Got swastika on the front. Got the American flag with a swastika. It says, Mark 100% Hardy. This is a collection of five books carefully packaged together. The Prince of Auschwitz Songs of Anne Frank. And Me, Black Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The Black DSM, Birth of the Black EMIN. You know, that's that hip-hopper, white hip-hopper, greatest rapper alive, and the Immaculate Collection, Assorted Writings of a Creative Soul. I'm telling you, well, when I read the first few pages of this, I thought, well, hey, this guy's all right. But if you read later on, it gets a little weird. I think this Hardy boy is, let's see here. Let me get what the good stuff was. Here's two or three pages I liked all right. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all white people are created equal. Well, I don't believe that, but still, is my personal interpretation of the U.S. Declaration of Independence. Although I'm an African-American leader, I believe in white power, white supremacy, white dominance, white patriarchy. In short, the white man must rule the world. Even black rapper Tupac Shakur recorded a song called White Man's World. From the ghettos of Harlem and Compton to the wealth of the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Beverly Hills, I believe that white superiority must permeate all social economic strata. As Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces, which have been overthrown by the Fourth Reich, I will destroy all institutions that promote ethnic diversity, gender equality, LGBT rights, and social justice. I've decided to use the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Change as my first target. If you're a minority, then you'll get spotted. Red beams on your ass, you're like a target. According to the intelligence report from the Reich Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Ku Klux Klan and various white militias in the South, Martin Luther King Center is located at 449 Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, Georgia. The center was founded by Dr. King's widow, Coretta Scott King. She began organizing the endeavor in her basement following her husband's 68 assassination. I have a squadron of F-16s from Lackland Air Force Base on standby, readying to launch targeted airstrikes against the King Center. Well, this gets better. However, before I launch the strike, I decide to consult with the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Quote, "Justice Thomas, I hope I haven't awakened you from your sleep," unquote, I spoke into the phone. Quote, "No, I was awake reading a law review article written by Justice Antonin Scalia," he replies. "Heil Hitler," Clarence Thomas offers. "Heil Hitler," I thundered back. "I'm calling you this late evening regarding a top-secret matter. The Reich is ready to destroy the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta," I explain. "And you want my opinion?" Justice Thomas anticipates. "Yes, I need your opinion." Quote, "As a self-hating black conservative, I hate Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy of racial equality and social justice. He was nothing but a communist and a troublemaker. Why did that black fool decide to challenge white racism? Blacks were better off with separate schools and separate drinking fountains. I think you should destroy the center," Clarence Thomas concludes. "Thank you, Justice Thomas. My wife, Virginia, and I will do our best to further white supremacy." Well, his wife is white. Don't look like he's furthering it very far. "After talking to the self-hating, white-worshipping Clarence Thomas, I'm 100% certain I will order the airstrike. To maintain the element of surprise, we do not warn the Civil Rights Center and Museum of the impending attack. This means there will be casualties. In order for a few to be immortal, many must die. I order the White House Secretary to contact the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Mark Anthony Welch." Quote, "General Walsh, yes, Commander-in-Chief," he replies. "I want you to launch Operation Hitler vs. MLK immediately." I intone, "Are you ordering the airstrike on the Martin Luther King Center?" General Welch asked to confirm. "Yes, I want the place destroyed immediately." Within 1 hour of our conversation, the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Change is completely destroyed. The entire compound is on fire. The local fire department is ordered not to intervene. Fearing more attacks, the members of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the Urban League go into hiding. Some flee the country. The systematic ethnic cleansing of America has begun. Well, I haven't heard of that place. I haven't heard where it's at or anything. And I haven't heard that the F-16s have destroyed it yet. So this must be in the future. This guy is... I don't think I'm going to waste my time reading a whole book because this guy is really out there. In fact, he starts his book off with "Ethnic Cleansing in the American Reich" as the title, and it's about him and Laura Bush having mad pornographic sex. I am not shitting you. This guy is way out there, man, and he's running for Senate, and he's showing pictures of all these big shots that he's had his picture taken with all these big shots. And, you know, some of these big shots, as long as, if a black runs up, they'll shake his hand immediately, afraid to offend a black, no matter who he is. Let's see. He had a whole bunch of pictures in here of people that he supposedly met, high-ranking people. That just shows you. Yeah, he's got himself in here as a press practicing Hasidic rabbi. He's got himself in here promoting mental health. It shows him looking like a goofball. Here's something. It said Psalms 40 by Sarah Cohen. "My name is Sarah Cohen. I died in Auschwitz-Birkenau in July 1943 along with a group of other victims. I was forced into gas chamber. We were packed in tightly. There was no room to move, to breathe. It was suffocating, humiliating, degrading. Naked, we were stripped down to the flesh, bone, and doors were closed, and we were locked in. There were cries and there were prayers. There were confused shouts, searching for deliverance, yet no Savior came." That might be because there is no Savior. Did you ever think of that when you're yelling to your God Yahweh, he ain't there. No divine providence. In the end, we all died. I was murdered by the Nazis, and I have come back to tell all people that we must be strong as a nation, as a people, never, never again. This thing is full of some real crazy stuff, man. Some real crazy stuff. Anyhow, if you want to get a copy of the book, it's $14.50. Shows him on the back cover here, shaking hands with some senator, some congressman. But anybody who, of any note that would have shaken hands with him, I'm certain would be judged a little nuts too. So anyhow, here's his address. You can email him at BarackObama2028@yahoo.com. Of course, he may be lying. Skype BarackObama2028, and his phone number comes up, 310-402-4499. You might want to interview this guy. It says, Hardy is America strong. He says, I have invited former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, former Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano, I hate that name, and the former Senator Jim DeMint to serve on my global security team, Mark Charles Hardy, candidate U.S. Senate. So there you go, boys. I'll tell you, we get all kinds of strange stuff in here. But let him go. Chaos is good. Confusion is good. The other side thinks that chaos does not serve our interest. Well, it does. I know that Wolf Wall Street didn't agree with me on that, but that's the way it goes. Surely don't think this new world order we're under now is serving our interests, that's for sure. So if chaos brings down the new world order, sounds like that's the way to go. Well, I decided not to get a shot in the neck. I did that once and it didn't work, and that's for my shoulder impingement and my arm pain and so forth like that. But I do think I'm going to try something that has been recommended highly, and that is, what is it? Wait a minute. It's yoga therapy. How about that? So a lot of Christians might say, well, man, that's getting in there with the devil. But it's very simple to do, and a lot of people have very good results from yoga therapy. In the meantime, I'm not going to be using my keyboard very much. I'm reverting to my Dragon program to where I can speak and convert the speech to print, and that's working out pretty good. Now, I want all you boys and girls to get the greeting ready for me when I arrive in Tel Aviv, because I'll be arriving in Tel Aviv on, I think Tuesday. Yeah, and I'm going to demand to go see Bibi. No, I'm not going to go see Bibi unless they drag me before Bibi. We'll see what happens. I'm going over there to see if I can find the baby Jesus, because this local man has been so generous as to pay for an all-expense trip to the State of Israel if I would go. He didn't think I would go. I said, well, hell yes, I'll go. And so I think Sunday I'll be taken off to the wonderful land of all the righteous people, the chosen people. Yeah. I wonder how long after I'm there, get off the plane, the Mossad's going to drag me away. That's going to be interesting. Maybe like John, my son, who got off the plane in Berlin, or Frankfurt, I guess it was. And they took him right back up the gangplank, sent him back to Chicago. He never even got to walk around in Germany. You know, I don't understand it. All these right-wing leaders, including Dr. Pierce, who's dead now, but all these guys seem to be able to go to all these countries and nobody ever stops them or anything. And I think it's sort of strange. I know that Pierce used to go over there and attend the French Conservative Party, lowbrow Nazis, low-level Nazis is all they were. I forget the name of the party. and which is interesting because Le Pen has gotten kicked out of his own party by his own daughter. But anyhow, and because when I said I was going to England about 20 years ago and just put that out there as an email, I think it was, or a press release, it came out that all the immigration ports in England were going to be watching for me, and they're going to grab me if I came in there. And of course, I can't go into Canada. But, you know, Duke gets to go all these places, and he's rarely given much trouble. And most of the time, he's not given any trouble at all. What's that all about? I don't quite understand that. I mean, old Tommy tries to go some other country, and unless it's Japan, I was welcomed with open arms in Japan. I was treated like a king in Japan. And so it's no wonder Hitler chose Japan as his ally, because they like white people. They like our kind of white people. I dined with the Nazi party in Japan. Then I dined with some of the higher muckety-mucks in the Japanese government. A lot of people won't believe who I had dinner with over there. You wouldn't believe it. I've told you that before, but it's true. And when I left Japan, the Tokyo chief of police showed up especially to present me with a set of Japanese swords. Now, can you imagine any chief of police in the United States meeting me at an airport to give me some kind of souvenir? And he gave me the crest of the city. It's one of these letter holders. It's a beautiful letter holder. Oh, man, this is a wacky world, baby. I personally think, too, a lot of our people who can possibly do it should take trips into China. And not to go over there waving a damn flag or something, but just as a citizen going in there. That's the way I'm going into Israel. I'm just going there, going to be on the tour, going to look around, keep my mouth shut, not try to piss anybody off, and see what's going on. And I think there's a lot of people out there that are racially conscious and racial separatists who do have enough funds that they could do that. And I think we should be doing that when at all possible, just to gain information and make ourselves aware of... I like to make sure all these people are supposed to hate American citizens really do. I don't think that most of these countries hate the United States. They hate the government. It seems the way... most of the time, that's what it is. They don't hate us individually, but they hate the government. And I do too, so we get along fine. Well, since it's Thursday, I'm going to do some more reading here that from my great friend, deceased Revelo P. Oliver, the smartest man I ever met. And it is June the 4th, 2015. Poor little Eve. As I have often remarked in these pages, Christianity is being stripped of the Western veneer that made it acceptable to our superstitious ancestors. And given the frantic excitation of religious fanaticism by our enemies at the present time, that is a phenomenon of prime importance. It was for that reason that I wasted an hour or two in looking through a 576 closely printed pages of enthusiastic rant by one E.G. White, entitled America in Prophecy, printed about 1987. According to the publisher, who modestly conceals his name, location, and the date of his printing, this paperback is a number one bestseller and a fine audiovisual production, whatever that is intended to mean. In such a book, one expects to admire the wonderful ingenuity of theologians' imagination and their dexterity in arranging words to create illusions in the consciousness of gullible readers. From this one, I learned, for example, that for 1,260 years after... let's see here... after Christianity was peddled to the ignorant Arians, the religion was entirely under the control of Satan, whose principal agent on earth was the Pope, and whose principal instrument was the Roman Catholic Church, which kept the Holy Book and the salvation out of the hands of the layman. That's why so millions of Roman Catholics are now turning on the spit in the eternal barbecue that Satan is running somewhere underground for inexplicable purposes of his own. all this satanic capture of Christianity was explicitly foretold by Daniel et al., but Jesus and his daddy evidently paid no attention in time to prevent it. And after it happened, they twiddled their thumbs for 1,260 years before giving some weights a secret nudge to become Protestants and redeem Christianity from satanic occupation. The author nevertheless admires and worships his indolent and furtive gods. I note one theological problem of great importance in these days of rampant feminism. Old Jesus, it seems, is going to shake the lead out of his nightgown pretty soon and get busy instead of covertly stirring up volcanoes or setting off earthquakes every once in a while to kill thousands of people and give them a hint he isn't dozing all the time. He will, for the first time since his dad begat him, take direct action. He'll come back to earth to set up his righteous dictatorship with a big bang. He'll land, of course, in Jerusalem, the center of the universe, and there he will sit on a throne high and lifted up, far above the city, on a foundation of burnished gold, unquote. He will raise from the dead all the righteous who have lived since his papa first made talking anthropoids. That enormous throng is sure to jam the narrow streets of Jerusalem, but the greatest of the resurrected is naturally given a place next to his boss. He is Adam, of course, and he is of lofty height and majestic form in stature, but little below the Son of God. As I imagine him from the description, he will resemble the young German warriors whose physical excellence so astonished the Jews' janissaries when they were stampeding against Germany in 1939 and 45. Now there is a profound soteriological problem in this vivid scene from which Eve, the recycled rib that had such an appetite for apples and knowledge, is most dramatically and emphatically absent. Is she being fried by some of Satan's imps in his cavernous realm underground? The apple woman, who is called Eve in the English Bibles, Eue in the Greek, and the New Testament Zoe in the Septuagint, and in the Hebrew HWH, which is pronounced Sheva in most theological seminaries, was undoubtedly, according to inerrant holy writ, the first of her sex and the ancestress of all the billions of females who came after her. Women today must feel an absorbing concern over her fate. Since the resurrected Adam has evidently forgotten his temptress, there are only two alternatives. Either poor Eve is going to spend eternity on a red-hot griddle, or she was just an animal anyway and was not resurrected because she had no more soul than quadrupeded bitches. The latter is, of course, a view that turns up now and then in religions derived from the Jews. It is implied in the Apocalypse, including in the New Testament, which tells us that after Jesus was busted up, the whole universe, including hundreds of galaxies that are millions of light years away, he will create a brand new earth for himself and his pets, 144,000 male homosexual Jews who will naturally have no use for nasty females. Some of the fathers of the church held that females have no souls, but their misogyny was restrained by their perception of how much property was in the possession of widows, and of how easily women can be detached from their property by spiritual things. The father accordingly invented the doctrine that females who have piously given their all for Jesus and his salesman will, when they die, be miraculously equipped with male sexual organs by old Jesus so that he can give them souls and thus qualify them for admission to an all-male heaven. And the orthodox doctrines of Islam teaches that women have no souls, so cannot survive to afflict their husbands after death. Husbands finally escape them. We have here a neat illustration of psychic difference between Jews and Semites. Jews could be content with an all-male heaven. Semites have faith that Allah will fill paradise with troops of whores created by the delectation of true believers. Now a houri H-O-U-R-I, Arabic, means black-eyed maiden. It is an exquisitely and perfectly beautiful damsel with fair complexion and black hair and eyes who is exempt from all the physical defects and temperamental deficiencies of mortal women. Is continuously eager to please a man in whatever ways his whims suggest, and is miraculously restored to virginity after every dalliance with him. What is more, there is an unlimited supply of whores, and every man in heaven may have as many as he wants. This arrangement will not appeal to my feminine contemporaries, but I think even they will agree that if a male Aryan has to choose between a Judeo-Christian and a Muslim, the heavens, there cannot be any possible doubt about which a man will elect. Allah Akbar. And the second writing by Dr. Oliver is On the Roof of the World. Our race's religiosity has determined so much of our tragic history and today so afflicts us with a desperate crisis that a study of religions necessarily holds an abiding interest for us. Some of my readers may wish to take an opportunity pleasantly to acquaint themselves with a major but little-known religion in the part of the world that is remote and was indeed inaccessible to white men before the end of the 19th century. Mipam, M-I-P-A-M, is a thoroughly enjoyable novel written by a Tibetan holy man, Lama Yongden, translated into English by Percy Lloyd of Pembroke College of Oxford, and published in London in 1938. It has just been reprinted by the State University of New York in Albany. It is a well-written novel which conforms structurally to the canons of literary criticism established for the genre by Saintsbury, Forrester, and Muir in the days when literature was still a part of our culture. They would have approved the form of the narrative and its style, however they would have endorsed, however little they would have endorsed the story. Lama Yongden professes to give his fiction of an authentic description of the religion we call Lamaism and of daily life in Tibet. So far as my very limited knowledge permits me to judge, he has done so by successfully as a trollop portrayed an Anglican church in British life in the series begun with Barchester Towers and within the same limitations. You will have noted the date of the publication. It antedates the suicide of the West, the several invasions of Tibet by the communist regime in China, and the wholesale massacres of Tibetans, which elicited no sympathy or interest from the tender-hearted Americans whose souls are convulsed with righteous indignation whenever a Jew yammers about how persecuted he is. Lama Yongden has described the conditions that no longer exist, and it is to Tibet before it was devastated that I refer in what follows. The Tibetan title Lama corresponds to the American Reverend. It is given to anyone who claims to be a holy man. Sounds like the niggers. Every nigger's a preacher, a reverend, the right reverend, Al Chopped and me. There are certain great lamas, the heads of abbots of many large monasteries. Each great lama is the reincarnation of his predecessor, and when he dies, will be reincarnated in his successor, who will be identified in childhood by certain signs that are verified by complicated texts and rites. They always have to get complicated, I'll tell you that. The greatest of the great are the Panchen Lama, who is the religious arbiter, and the Dalai Lama, whose position as abbot of a huge monastery on the outskirts of Lhasa, the capital city, enabled him to make himself the political master of the nation and indeed call himself a monarch. Lamaism is a peculiar religion. I shall not cite here treatises on it, but I shall suggest that you may discern something of its essential spirit by inspecting the iconography of its gods. If you have an aesthetic sense, you will learn much intuitively from inspecting the hundreds of excellent plates in the two Lamaistic pantheons from Harvard University Press, 1937. In the 6th century B.C., Gautama, an Aryan princeling, on the northern frontier of India formulated a bleakly pessimistic philosophy that markedly resembles Schopenhauer's. This high doctrine of negation, for reasons that would require an extensive historical explanation, became extremely popular but was variously interpreted by at least 18 rival schools, each of them which claimed alone to preserve the true teaching of Gautama, the Buddha, and Gautama's austere atheism was gradually contaminated and obscured by the usual theological techniques, so that a philosophy that was intended to supplant religion was converted into just another elaborate and learned superstition. Under the Emperor Asoka in the 3rd century BC, a form of Buddhism became the official belief of India, retaining some of its philosophical substance but becoming in effect an evangelical religion that sent its missionaries throughout the known Akyamine. From the work of the missionaries of Asia Minor, some elements of the religion were copied in the Jewish mishmash of the Essenes and early Christianity. The official Buddhism of Asoka's time pages are getting, I think this one got a little wet at one time. Pages are sticking together. Responds with fair proximity to the great division of the religion known as the Hinayana, which now survives in Ceylon. In northern India, Buddhism, in competition with the worst aspects of the Hindu religion, multiplied and vulgarized gods and absorbed most of the doctrines of the Tantric cults, which so horrified our Victorian ancestors and which could still give hints to the most vicious of Jewish pornographers in Hollywood. This Buddhism became a grotesque religion called Mahayana, which was exported by missionaries to Tibet, where it further incorporated most of the hocus-pocus of the local shamans. This form of the religion, which became even more corrupt in both theology and practice, still survives in Tibet, where its professed clergy are distinguished by garments, at least hats, that are red, which was the sacred color of Buddhism when it flourished in India, whereas everyone knows all forms of Buddhism have been virtually extinct for centuries. How extensive this survival of the old cult is, I do not know. It is barely mentioned in the novel. In the 14th century, a learned lama, Tsongkhapa, undertook a drastic reform of the religion, reviving as much as he could of the Hinayana, but necessarily having to accept a compromise, retaining what he regarded as the less objectionable doctrines of the then-dominant cult. The Tibetan Reformation swept the nation and was accepted sooner or later by all of the great lamas and imposed on their monasteries and on the new monasteries that were founded by the renewed religious fervor. Its holy men are distinguished by yellow apparel. The religion reformed by Tsongkhapa is what we mean by Lamaism. With so much of an introduction, you may turn to the novel. Its protagonist is Mipan, the younger of two surviving sons of the moderately prosperous middle-aged Tibetan, a veteran of improvised Tibetan army, which futilely resisted the British troops led by Colonel Young Husband when he forced his way into Tibet and to Lhasa in 1904. Mipan's mother is the younger of his father's wives and widow of his father's eldest son. Mipan's birth was attended by portents, a supernatural light in the sky, rain that ended a disastrous drought, strains of celestial music heard by his mother, and a large, perhaps inspired leopard that benignly watched the birth through a window. Although Mipan was not suspect his identity until years after, he becomes adult at 16. He is reincarnation of the great lama of the large monastery in a remote and relative isolated part of Tibet. We follow Mipan's life through his childhood in a society that is ably portrayed. One mark of his sacred heredity is one that he does not recognize. Leopards and bears neither fear nor attack him, but on occasion bear him company because they sense his compassionate love for all living things. His career passes through various vicissitudes, and some of his adventures put him in perils that he eludes by luck and his wits. Although he is drawn to a religious life, he eventually becomes quite prosperous merchant. Don't they all? Still unaware of his previous existence and the sacred vocation it imposes on him. Every novel must include the amatory intrigue, and a large part of its plot must concern the obstacles that at first prevent the union of the lovers and the way in which those impediments are eventually overcome if the novel is to have a happy ending. At the age of 9, Mipan, as he is destined to do, falls in love with a girl of 6. And the daughter of a rich merchant. Well, that helps. The obstacles, however, are a kind of which Aryan readers are unaccustomed. When the girl has attained the proper age, her father is quite ready to marry her to Mipan. But the difficulty arises because Mipan does not want to share her with his elder brother in the polyandry. That is the normal form of marriage in Tibet. Polyandry, by which all brothers of a family marry to share one wife, is an eminently practical form of marriage. It prevents excessive expenditure in marriage settlements, conserves intact the undivided their inheritance, and promotes cooperation and brotherly love, since none of the brothers can tell which of the children he sired. Monogamy is available for those who can afford it, and can persuade a father to entrust his daughter to a marriage in which she may so easily become a widow. But men who can afford monogamy usually and quite naturally opt for polygamy, as do most of the very wealthy and luxurious taste. Mipan is so eccentric, however, that he wants only one wife and would want only one even if he could afford more, but insists on exclusive possession of her. The girl's father prudently reasons that marriage is only a younger brother to an only younger brother, and one with quite odd notions at that, would be too precarious an establishment of a daughter that whom he has found. Stick with me, boys and girls. Revlo really gets into this stuff. The novel will be richly rewarded to the connoisseurs of spiritual things. It will delight all who feel an urge to ameliorate the life of all mankind. Christians who dote on gospels about love will find the great Lama's discourse a more complete and coherent doctrine than any which they are familiar. Pity for the unfortunate and the compassion for all sentient beings who offer our emotions that spring from one of the noblest tropisms of our racial psyche. They are not to be denied or suppressed, although sane men moderate them by prudence. Our idealists must own that their own velleity to abolish all suffering is most fully expressed in the fifth wisdom of Lamaism, the doctrine that teaches that, quote, no durable happiness, nor yet security, nor any sentient being can exist while others are a prey to suffering, unquote. That truth cannot be questioned, and you may take it to heart. In practical terms, it means we've got ourselves born at the wrong planet, in the wrong universe. And that's the reading from Revelo P. Oliver, the smartest guy I ever met. Now that we've learned all about the Buddhists and all that kind of stuff, going back for thousands of years, let's discuss the extermination thesis by Dr. Revelo P. Oliver. At a cocktail or at a Holocaust seminar sponsored by the Zionists. This was actually written by Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. If my memory serves me correctly, it was one of the greatest economists of the 20th century, Ludwig von Mises, who admonished us that a cocktail party is no place in which to discuss such complicated and demanding subjects as economics. Such an admonishment is equally valid for the discussion of such complicated historical questions as the extermination thesis. Nevertheless, it would be unrealistic to assume that the subject never comes up at cocktail parties, especially in the case of persons who are reputed to be skeptical about extermination. I will comment on one thing. He holds Ludwig von Mises up as this great guy on economics. And I was into Ludwig von Mises 30, 40 years ago when I was thinking about, what the hell's the name of that party? Well, anyhow, which I don't agree with von Mises. Von Mises was used by the Reagan bunch for their trickle-down economy idea, which was a total failure. Unless they read Ludwig von Mises wrong, and I haven't read him for so long, I forget what he said. We who have expressed doubts about the extermination thesis are often victims of gross oversimplification. Oversimplifying remarks such as the following can be heard at gatherings of laymen. Quote, oh, the revisionists, aren't those the people like the ones who adhere to the flat earth theory and the ones who say that the Holocaust never happened, unquote. Such remarks, of course, manifest just the sort of attitudes inculcated by Zionist propaganda, who have no inclination to admit the complexity of the Holocaust question, much less to admit that it is a question in the first place. When a doubter of the extermination thesis discusses it at a cocktail party, if he must, he's up against a number of psychological disadvantages as a result of the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the Holocaust industry. I think it's approaching a billion, at least a billion, maybe 2 billion. Industry is to spread its products. The doubter is usually outnumbered in the first place. People who have believed in the extermination thesis for many years as a result of having seen numerous television shows and docudramas, two of which were reviewed in Liberty Bell in May 1983 and May 1985, and who have read popular fictional accounts of it, are typically irritated, indeed offended, by having their simplistic, naive beliefs challenged. That is human nature. They feel that their intelligence and capacity for critical judgment has been insulted. Of course, in many cases, it's about time that they should be insulted. All too many American political decisions, especially those pertaining to foreign policy and national defense, have been based on propaganda myths, which originated during the time of the Second World War, myths which have never been destroyed by objective analysis and factual knowledge. The masters of our popular media characteristically seldom have the slightest inclination to furnish such objective analysis and facts. Examples of what can come at cocktail parties are Uncle Joe's account of the emaciated bodies he saw when units of his division helped to liberate Dachau, or Cousin George seeing the fake post-war gas chambers at Dachau when he was stationed in Munich during the 50s. After all, these tales prove the Holocaust, do they not? Then there are the books of such great historians as those of William L. Shire, who have waxed rich from their sensational, but by no means always accurate and balanced journalistic accounts of the Second World War. Such books are no doubt owe much of their success to the fact that they help ease American minds about the blunders their government made during what could be well called the war to make the world safe for communism and Judaism, I guess, or capitalism, predatory capitalism. It took the United States only a little over, that's one thing that disturbs me. A lot of these guys are researchers, and some of them do a pretty good job, but they tend to be on the right, and they tend to support capitalism. And I think that's one of their big mistakes. At least that's my opinion. It took the United States only a little over 3 years to defeat directly or indirectly Germany and its allies, Finland, Hungary, Romania, Italy, and others, the nations which were engaged in a titanic, desperate struggle against communism, or what I call state capitalism. That's why I would try to encourage right-wingers to name it what it was. It was state capitalism. I've gone into that many times. We have subsequently been engaged for over 40 years in trying to defend ourselves against communism. Then there are the incorrigible Democrats, not necessarily rarities at cocktail parties, who retain the idée fixe that Roosevelt and Truman could not be held responsible for the blunders that led to the dangers, anxieties, and indeed genocides which were results of the Soviet military and diplomatic victories of 1945 and later. In addition, there are those certain kinds of religious beliefs who believe that Jews can do no wrong, that they should be reminded of Isaiah 19:2. One of these areas of grossest distortion about the extermination thesis lies in the background. Most Holocaust fiction of the sort with the American public has been inundated for decades, hardly conveys the fact that whatever happened to the Jews in Europe during Second World War took place during a desperate war in which the anti-Comintern powers of Europe were themselves threatened with genocide in any number of forms. Threats which were indeed actually carried out to a greater or lesser extent by the military defeat of the anti-Comintern powers, and even before it. One need only think of Dresden, the fate of the German civilian population of Berlin and Prague, the expulsions of millions of Germans east of the Oder-Neisse line, the terrible fates of the Baltic and Croatian populations, and so on, by the anti-Comintern forces. By the way, we mean those nations and ethnic groups which resisted the communist onslaught towards the West. These included not only Germany and Italy, but also Hungary, Finland, Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, Croatia, and France after 1940. In addition, a number of other national and ethnic groups furnished notable numbers of volunteers, such as the Baltic nations, Ukraine, Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, Norway, Denmark, and even Russians. For various reasons, few Americans are aware of these facts. Victory has many fathers, but defeat is an orphan. Anyone who questions the average American's acceptance of the extermination thesis usually has to contend with a great ignorance about the most elemental facts of the Second World War. That's for sure, I'll tell you. Most people don't even know what the hell was happening, or what happened afterwards, or what's happening right now. Many Americans, for example, do not even realize that England and France declared war on Germany, not the other way around. In spite of the disadvantages which someone questioned the extermination thesis has at a gathering of laymen or at a Holocaust seminar, there are some effective strategies he can use and some devastating arguments he can cite. It is a well-established principle of educational psychology that effective teaching can often be based on the procedure of going from the known to the unknown. This involves taking facts and concepts already familiar with the learner and then building on them during the further learning process. We enumerate below some of the most effective strategies and arguments which can be employed by those disputing the extermination theory thesis among laymen. Number one, one of the most disarming questions which can be posed the average acceptor of Zionist propaganda is simply the inquiry as to what books he has read which dispute the Holocaust. In perhaps 99% of the cases, such people will concede that they have read none. The question becomes even more effective when specific titles and authors are mentioned, such as those by the books of Dr. Butz, Dr. Stoglich, Dr. App, Dr. Weber, and so on. Then the acceptors of Zionist propaganda, their positions already severely weakened, can be rendered completely helpless by being asked if they arrived at judgments on the basis of hearing only one side of a complicated and controversial subject, and how a court of law could ever arrive at justice if it permitted only one side of the litigation to state its case before the court. Two, one very effective way to remind the average proponent of the extermination thesis is his ignorance is to ask him how many Jews died in Europe during the war and then follow up on the question by asking how many military deaths were suffered by the United States. Few will know. I've done that a million times. Relatively few will have even heard of Operation Keel Haul. Certainly an event as significant as the sufferings of Jews in Europe during the war, and probably one which involved more deaths. The ignorance about the war revealed by such simple question is often astonishing and embarrassing to those who cannot answer them. 3. At Holocaust seminars, there are often survivors present. They should be asked the appropriate question, such as how they as individuals survived the war. Such survivors constitute, of course, living proof against the extermination thesis. 4. Many laymen have heard at least something about the Battle of the Warsaw Ghetto, which has been publicized by a number of American films and books, as well as the communist government of Poland as late as April 1943. The famous revolt of the Warsaw Ghetto involved enough Jews to hold off German military units for several weeks. That an extermination order as early as January 1942, the time of the Wannsee Conference, how could so many Jews have still been present in Warsaw as late as April 43? 5. We Americans interned persons of Japanese descent within a few weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor, supposedly for the military security. These facts are quite well known. By contrast, the German authorities were quite dilatory about interning Jews. But by April 43, Germany's authorities had ample reasons to consider Jews to constitute a military threat to their desperately thinly spread armed forces, which had all they could do to fend off massive Soviet attacks on the Eastern Front, to man defensive positions along the western coast of Europe against the coming invasion of the Anglo-American forces, and to defend themselves against partisans, especially in the eastern areas. Is it any wonder that German authorities decided to relocate and intern Jews? 6. The fate of Anne Frank is fairly widely known through her famous diary. It constitutes one of the best disproofs of the extermination thesis. This frail girl was deported from the Netherlands to the Auschwitz in 44. But when the Soviet forces came nearer and nearer, she was transported to Belsen, far to the west, where she died just several weeks before the end of the war during a typhus epidemic, a fate shared by many interned Jews. Such relocations at the cost of very scarce transportation facilities and guard personnel would hardly have been carried out if there had been a general extermination order. 7. Germany, in a country about the size of the state of Texas, was very effective blockaded both world wars. The blockades were prime factors in the defeat of Germany in both wars. Since about 1870, the German population grew to such an extent that Germany had to... Germany had to export and trade food for manufactured products. When the powerful British Navy blockaded Germany beginning in September 39, food became scarce both in Germany and eventually throughout Europe. The scarcity of food was directed as a powerful weapon against Germany, but it harmed friend and foe alike, including, of course, the countries occupied by German forces and the Jewish population under German control. Jews were thus no exception in suffering from these circumstances created by the Allied blockade, along with other Europeans. By the spring of 1945, Germans were suffering from severe scarcity of food, as many American soldiers in Germany could observe at the time. Nevertheless, a number of Jewish publications contains pictures of persons liberated from Auschwitz in January 45 who looked fairly well nourished. Auschwitz, we must recall, was far to the east of the heaviest Allied bombing attacks on German transportation facilities. 8. During the closing months of the war, the Allied air forces had nearly completely control of the air and could bomb cities' transportation facilities almost without impediment. Under these circumstances, a chaos prevailed and it became very difficult to supply the conservation camps with food and medication, what food and medication were available. Hunger and disease then took a heavy toll among the inmates. Allied units which captured the camps encountered many emaciated corpses of the victims of hunger and disease. In at least one instance, Nordhausen, the Allied bombardment, was directly responsible for killing many inmates. Even after the capture of the camps by Allied units, the internees continued to die, in some cases as a result of supplies of food of kinds to which they were no longer accustomed. 9. The demographic data in connection with the Jewish mortality during the war are complicated and largely elusive. Many Americans however, have noticed that the huge number of Jews who came to North America during and immediately after the war. The huge presence of Jewish population of Palestine, some 3 million, is largely the result of immigration from Europe. Prior to 1933, only a small percentage of population of Palestine was Jewish. As late as 1939, in fact, only 445,457 Jews were counted in Palestine. Now remember, I read you before that it was Hitler's design to move the Jews to Palestine. That was the big thing. And he did get a whole lot of them out of there. Okay. The curious layman could be referred to Walter Sanning's book, Dissolution of the Eastern European Jewry. From Jewish sources, we know that there were approximately as many Jews in the territory of the present German Federal Republic after the war as there was before. It is fairly easy to demonstrate that the famous 6 million figure usually given for the Jewish mortality is absurd, so absurd that it has a tendency to discredit other Holocaust claims. To judge the International Red Cross statistics, the number of Jews who died in German relocation camps during the war might be exceeded by the number of German civilians killed in the bombing of Dresden on the 13th and 14th of February, 1945. 10. Many aerial surveillance photos of Auschwitz were taken by Allied airplanes during 1944. Several years ago, these were released by the American government. They represent one of the best disproofs of the extermination thesis. 11. The motivations for the huge Holocaust industry must be constantly stressed. Summer 1982, the well-known forgery factories of the USSR and other communist countries should be pointed out, even as noted in the U.S. News and of 17 February 1986, page 74. The USSR itself committed so many war crimes that it's still attempting to obliterate them by contrast. A huge Holocaust museum is being erected in Washington to commemorate the alleged Jewish victims of National Socialism, where, though it is a monument to the millions of victims of communism or state capitalism, the present threat to our very existence. 12. The lack of willingness to debate the revisionists publicly is a striking demonstration of the lack of validity of the Holocaust claims. Well, sometimes they do debate, but the way and the place and how they do the debates is totally rigged. The destruction on July 4, 1984, of the headquarters of the Institute for Historical Review is one of the most striking demonstrations of this resistance to bringing the debate out in the open. The war crimes trials are frequently cited to support the Holocaust claims. One of the most effective arguments against their validity is the torture use and obtained confessions employed at the trials. The lack of normal judicial procedures and standards of the Nuremberg trial. You know, this destruction, the firebombing of the Institute for Historical Review, I was right in the middle of that because I was trying to help Willis Carter and the boys figure out who did it, because we knew the cops or the FBI, none of the rest of them would ever find out. Well, I found out, but nothing was ever done, even though I publicized it. I had people that were involved in the stock market and stock selling and all that kind of stuff. And they were able to get into the stockman, whoever handled the stock for Irv Rubin, his personal stock. And very shortly after that building was burnt to the ground, Irv Rubin's account, there were $10,000 put into his account with no real understanding or reason behind it. So it was we're pretty sure that Irv Rubin was paid off to burn down the Institute for Historical Review. And so, anyhow, that's another crime I pretty well solved, but no one wants to give me credit for it, but that's okay. 13. As to Uncle John's belief that the emaciated corpses which he saw when his American military unit liberated a concentration camp proved the Holocaust, Uncle John's niece should be asked several questions. Just how many corpses did he see? What percentage of the 6 million does this number represent? From what cause did the victims die? 14. rather well known is the complaint by Pope Pius XII remaining silent during what is claimed to have been mass extermination of Jews in Europe. The silence of the Pope has long irritated the proponents of the extermination thesis, who characteristically claim that the Pope must have known about the Holocaust through various channels of information available to him, that he was therefore an immoral man for not protesting the great crime. At least, he was a coward. The Pope, however, could hardly have made any fears about the safety of the Vatican after June 4, 44, since the Allied forces moved into Rome on that day. There is even a play which was written about the Pope's alleged sin of omission by R. Hotchkiss in 1963. What the proponents of the extermination thesis do not suggest, however, is that there was simply no Holocaust to protest. Well, the Cannes Film Festival this year brought out a new movie that is a positive movie about Pope Pius XII. But I'm sure they figure some way of saying the Germans were all bad and the extermination policy was true. I doubt whether it tries to clean up the image of the Pope, but I don't think it's trying to clean up the image of the Germans. 15. It has been argued by proponents of the extermination thesis that still extant and never classified records of the Reichsbahn, German public railway system, support their thesis because these records reveal the transportation of large numbers of internees to the East, while records of their return are not to be found. Obviously, as was pointed out in the discussion of Shoah in Bulletin number 8, such records proved nothing with regard to what was done with the internees once they arrived at their destinations, various relocation and labor camps. The fact that the trains returned empty also would prove nothing except that the internees had been relocated for some length of time or another. 16. The great number of inconsistencies in the Holocaust material and number of improbable or impossible accounts in it have been the publicly expressed concern of some Jewish historians who fear that revisionists have been given a ready opportunity to discredit the whole material by pointing out some of these absurdities, such as those to be found in the writings of Eli Wiesel. An example of such concern was expressed by Gita Sereni in articles in the readily available periodical The New Statesman, July 17, 1981, and November 2, 1979. The strategies and arguments for informing laymen enumerating above are simple samples which can be supplemented and adapted to circumstances by well-informed revisionists. So there you go. That's a pretty good writing there by... God, I forgot his name. The article was by Weber, who has been with the... I think he's the leader of the IHR now. I'm not sure. I used to be quite involved with them and knew all about what was going on and everything else, but since I pissed off Willis Cardo for exposing some of his shenanigans on the Gene Farrell Edison estate fraud, they don't talk to me and none of his friends talk to me, but that's okay. But for all you new people, that's old news. I won't rehash it. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day. Yeah, tomorrow's Ladies Day. Let's see. I thought someone sent me a request for a song. Maybe it was merchandise. Anyhow, if you requested a song, send it to me again, and I'll get it on there tomorrow. 14-5, and I'm getting ready for the big trip. Maybe. I don't know, man. Bombadida, 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 bombadida
clouds when we're together. Just sing a song and think about sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet.